Evening, I invite you to open your Bibles tonight. Book of Psalms, 91, 91st Psalm this evening. That's where we're going to pick up. I'm going to read from there and do some things with this psalm this evening. So you're going to have your Bible opened up to Psalm 91. Good to see you. Glad that you are here this evening. Appreciate the encouragement, the gift of your presence. To our visitors, we hope that you feel warmly welcome this evening. You are honored guests, and we are thankful for the good that you have done us by gifting us with yourself. And trusting us enough to worship God with us this evening. We're glad that you're here. If you've never been here before and would like to know more about what's going on in here, we'd be happy to talk with you after services, or you can leave a visitor's card behind with someone to get back in hold of you, and we'll be happy to follow up on your convenience, but we're glad that you are here this evening. Psalm 91, have your Bible open this evening. I'm going to begin reading the whole psalm, all 16 verses of it, Psalm 91. He who dwells in the shelter of the Most High will abide in the shadow of the Almighty. I will say to the Lord, my refuge and my fortress, my God in whom I trust. For it is He who delivers you from the snare of the trapper, from a deadly pestilence. He will cover you with His pinions. It's a fancy word for wings. He will cover you with His wings, and under His wings you may seek refuge. His faithfulness is a shield and a bulwark. Picture the idea of a big fortress wall to hide behind. You will not be afraid of the terror by night, or the arrow that flies by day, or the pestilence that stalks in darkness, or of destruction that lays waste at noon. 1,000 may fall at your side, and 10,000 even at your right hand, but it shall not approach you. You will only look on with your eyes and see the recompense of the wicked. For you have made the Lord my refuge, even the Most High, your dwelling place. No evil will befall you, nor will any plague come near your tent. For He will give His angels charge concerning you, to guard you in all your ways. And they will bear you up in their hands so that you do not strike your foot against a stone. And you will tread upon the lion and the cobra, the young lion and the serpent you will trample down. Because He has loved me, and this is God speaking here, the voice switches. Because He has loved me, therefore I will deliver him, says God. I will set him securely on high because he has known my name. He will call upon me and I will answer him. I will be with him in trouble. I will rescue him and honor him. With a long life I will satisfy him and let him see my salvation. So here we have Psalm 91, right there in the heart of the Psalter. It's a psalm that for centuries, both by Jews and by Christians, it's a psalm that for centuries has been read as promising God's protection to His people. Did you catch the language at the heart of that psalm? No matter what's going on around you, terror at night, an arrow during the day, pestilence, whatever it may be, no threat to the person of God. 1,000 may fall at your side, even 10,000 at your right hand. And yet it won't happen to you. And then comes that verse 10. No evil, so emphatic, no evil will befall you, nor will any plague come near your tent. For centuries, this psalm has been read as God promising His protection to His people. No harm to the righteous. And so this psalm has long been seen as emphasizing the security of those who trust and live with God. God's promised protection. It's no wonder then that when Jesus was here on earth, it's no wonder then that when Satan takes Jesus into the wilderness and then begins to take him around, as it were, to tempt him, to test him, to try him, it's no wonder then that in Matthew's account, in the second of the face-off between Jesus and Satan, Satan says this to Jesus after he took him to the holy city, that's Jerusalem, and puts him up on the pinnacle of the temple. That's the highest part of the temple platform over the Kidron Valley there, where a couple hundred feet from that point down to the bottom. And he basically says to Jesus, if you're the Son of God, throw yourself down because it is written. And here's what we just read a moment ago. It's Psalm 91. It's written, He will command His angels concerning you. And on their hands they will bear you up, lest you strike your foot against a stone. Hey, Jesus, remember Psalm 91? Everybody loves Psalm 91. Remember, that's nothing evil, nothing bad happens to God's people. In fact, the angels will catch you. That's what Psalm 91 says. So, hey, Jesus, let's take this out for a test drive. Let's try this thing out. Before you do this whole Messiah thing, let's see if God's really trustworthy. Let's see what God's all about. He's made these great promises. Wouldn't you like to know if He's a man or a being of His word? Let's find out, Jesus. It says your foot's not going to catch on the rock. Why don't you jump and see what happens? The problem here is not that Psalm 91 doesn't apply to Jesus. That's not the problem here with what Satan's doing and what Satan's saying. The problem is not that Psalm 91 is not true or deficient or that it doesn't apply to Jesus. It applies to Jesus just like it applies to every other righteous person who wants to have a relationship with God, who wants to trust in God, and wants to find security in God. Sure, it applies to Jesus. That's not the problem with what Satan's doing or the spirit in which he is quoting it to Jesus. The problem is not that the text does not apply to Jesus. The problem is that what Satan is implying this psalm is all about, and the way he throws it up at Jesus, what Satan seems to be implying about this psalm and about its promises, is that it somehow gives the righteous the right to demand of God the where, the when, the how of his keeping his promises. The text says that God will protect the righteous. No evil will befall you, but we want to know when, where, and how. Wouldn't you like to know that, Jesus? Satan tempts him. Let's force God's hand. Jump. And see what happens. See, what Satan is doing with Jesus is Satan is tempting Jesus to turn religion and to turn faith into superstition. You know what superstition is? Superstition is where you try to control the misfortunes that may happen in your life. And so sometimes we'll talk about something and we'll say, knock on wood. You ever done that? What are we talking about? That old superstitious idea that if you knock on wood when you say something or do something, hopefully it won't happen or it will happen. But the point is, or you throw salt over their shoulder, or you don't walk under a ladder, or you don't cross paths with a black cat. I mean, you know the whole routine, right? We've got all sorts of superstitions in our culture. And the point of superstition is you can put the supernatural in your power. You can basically control or keep away misfortune by doing certain rituals and doing certain things. And basically what Satan is asking Jesus to do is to enter the realm of superstition. We don't think about it that way, but that's what he's in fact doing. He's asking Jesus to be superstitious. Let's see if this really works or not. Let's see if we can control the misfortune that might befall your path, Jesus. Let's put God to the test. And Jesus knows exactly what Satan is doing in this regard, which is why he quotes back to him Deuteronomy chapter 6. Jesus says to him, again, it is written, you shall not put the Lord your God to the test. And what's interesting, of course, there is the text that Jesus chooses to quote. He quotes Deuteronomy 6 and verse 16, you shall not put the Lord your God to the test. The rest of the line that Jesus quotes goes this way, as you tested him at Massah. Well, Jesus knows his Bible. Jesus has got the whole thing in mind. What's he talking about? As you tested God at Massah, what's he talking about? What was Moses talking about? Jesus is quoting Moses. Well, what was Moses talking about when he basically said, don't ever try to treat God superstitiously. Don't try to control God in the where, when, and how in which God's going to keep his promises to his people. Don't you ever do that. What was Moses talking about? Don't test God. Well, the story goes like this. It goes back a little bit further. It goes back to Exodus chapter 17. It goes back to Exodus chapter 17, just shortly after Israel had come out of Egypt and slavery. Now, you remember how God gets Israel out of Egyptian slavery. It's a stunning story, isn't it? It's a great miracle of the Old Testament, the Exodus, the parting of the Red Sea. Remember the story? Moses comes back to Pharaoh, says several times, let my people go. Remember what Pharaoh says? Pharaoh says, I don't know your God. Hey, I'm not going to let my free labor, my slaves go. No way, no how. And so a series of 10 plagues, God smites Egypt. Remember the story? 10th plague, culmination of it all, the death of the firstborn, literally decapitating Pharaoh's house. You tried to kill my people. Remember when Pharaoh's trying to kill all the sons of Israel? I'll take your children. Your firstborn are gone. You tried to kill my people, I'll take yours. I'll decapitate Pharaoh's house. I'll remove his successor, his heir. And then, of course, Pharaoh says, get out. And as they're getting out, Pharaoh has a change of heart because he's so stubborn. And so basically, when Israel is backed up against the Red Sea and the Egyptian army closing in, remember what God does? I love the way it's put later on in Exodus 15 in a more poetic fashion. With a blast of his nostrils, the song says in Exodus 15, the great east wind in Exodus 14. But it sounds so much cooler to say basically God sneezed and the sea parted, doesn't it? The divine blast of his nostrils and the sea parts, the great miracle par excellence in the Old Testament, when God delivers his people against all odds and against even the laws of nature itself. And you would think that God's people, having seen what he did to Egypt, having seen what he did to Pharaoh's household, you would have thought, wouldn't you, that Israel, as she got into the wilderness, would have figured, you know, God's got this under control. God will take care of us. Yet that's not what happened. It only took Israel 3 months from the parting of the Red Sea to when they got to Sinai. And yet in those mere three months, think about that. That's basically from Thanksgiving until now. In a mere 3 months, Repeatedly, she begins to doubt her God. Israel begins to doubt the deliverer. And so in Exodus chapter 70, one of those instances in which they doubt on the road to Sinai, they begin to doubt that their God goes down. So all the congregation of the people of Israel moved on from the wilderness of Sin by stages according to the commandment of the Lord and camped at Rephidim. But there was no water for the people to drink. And therefore the people quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water to drink." And Moses said to them, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord?" But the people thirsted there for water. The people grumbled against Moses and said, "Why did you bring us out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?" Because, of course, God doesn't know anything about water. No. God can't do anything here in the wilderness. Oh, he can part seas. He can maybe split water, but he can't make it. What are we going to do, Moses? So Moses cried to the Lord, "What shall I do with this people? They're almost ready to stone me." The Lord said to Moses, "Pass on before the people, taking with you some of the elders of Israel, take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile, and go, and behold, I will stand before you there on the rock of Horeb, and you will strike the rock, and water will come out of it, the people will drink." And Moses did so in the sight of all the elders of Israel, and he called the name of the place Massah. Don't remember what Moses said in Deuteronomy, what Jesus quotes? "Don't test the Lord like you did in Massah." He called the name of the place Massah and Meribah, which are basically words in Hebrew for troubling, quarreling, strife. Called the name of the place Massah because of the quarreling of the people of Israel and because they tested the Lord by saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" Twice this way Exodus tells the story emphasizes the fact that whether it was in Moses' words explicitly or in the commentary at the end, they were putting God to the test. And Jesus has read his Bible, and he says to Satan, "Listen, I know better than to put God to the test." How are they putting God to the test? Because they were demanding, basically, they basically were demanding that God prove himself. That God owed them such that God had to prove himself to them. Is the Lord among us or not? Isn't that implicitly what Satan's saying to Jesus? If you are the Son of God, throw yourself down. Let's find out what happens. Let's see if God's really on your side or not. Instead of trusting in what he's already said, let's find out. Jump. Now, I don't know about you, but I would think, I'd be pretty sure God was on my side before I jumped. But it's amazing, Satan was never very good at what he does in one sense. So here's the thing. In counterpart, when you go back to what Jesus was quoting, what Jesus was saying, there's more than to what he says back to Satan, because a lot of times when you quote from the Old Testament, when Old Testament citations are given, it's the whole context that's in mind. Kind of like what we just played out here when Jesus just simply says, "Don't test the Lord your God." And Deuteronomy says, like at Massah, Massah explains that. Basically, that's where Israel basically said, "Let's see if God's really with us or not. Let's demand God show himself and provide for us on our terms." The rest of the passage that Jesus quotes at Satan goes this way. "Not just that you shall not put the Lord your God to the test as you tested him at Massah, but you shall diligently keep the commandments of the Lord your God and his testimonies and his statutes which God has commanded you." See, here's what's going on. Satan wants Jesus to attempt to manipulate God. He wants Jesus to become superstitious. Let's see if you throw some salt over your shoulder or stay away from the black cats. Let's see what will happen here. Let's see if you can control misfortune in your life. Let's see if you can get God to do what you want, when you want, the way you want. Let's see if we can make God do what you want him to do, when you want him to do it. Satan wants Jesus to attempt to manipulate God, to basically discern if God's promises are trustworthy or not. But Jesus understands, and here's the thing, Jesus understands what he says back to Satan. Jesus understands that for humans, our task is not to test God. That is to prove God, to test God, to see if he's up to the task or not. Our job is not to test God. Our job is to trust God. And there's a world of difference, ladies and gentlemen. Our job is not to test God, to see if he's worthy or not of our allegiance. Rather, in the sense that the passage Jesus quotes says, your job is not to test him, your job is to obey him. You know what? You don't worry about how God's going to do it or when he's going to do it or the way he's going to do it. You know what your job is? Your job is diligently keep the commandments of the Lord your God. His testimonies, his statutes that he's commanded you, that's your job. You know what you have all the power in the world to do? Obey God. You have no power to force God to do something he doesn't want to do. You have no power to force God to do something when he doesn't want to do it. But you have all the power in the world to control who you are and how you live. You have all control in your life to choose to obey and do what God says. Our job, ladies and gentlemen, and this is what Jesus tried to get Satan to understand, is not to test God. It's to trust God. It is to obey Him. God doesn't have to audition for the role of God of the universe. He's that by nature because He made the universe. He's not on audition. He's not on trial here. He is the God. He is the great King. He is the maker of all. As humans, our job is to give God our trust and our obedience, nothing more, nothing less. And besides, as we so often forget, from the Bible's perspective, it's not about whether God can be trusted. From the Bible's perspective, it's about whether God can trust humans. That's the real point of the Bible, isn't it? The Bible's not whether or not about whether or not God is trustworthy, as though we need to test Him. The real point of the Bible is, can God trust us? I mean, think about the prophets. You read the prophets of the Old Testament, and their lament over and over again is, God does so much for you, and then you betray Him. God does so much for you, and then you are unfaithful. Or even think about it this way. The book of Job, we talk about this from time to time, but I think this is so important to understand. We typically read the book of Job as about basically the ways of God among man and about how God works in the world. But bottom line is, the book of Job is not answering questions about how God works in the world and why bad things sometimes happen to good people. That's not what the book of Job is about at all. The book of Job is not answering questions about God. The book of Job is asking questions about man. That's what it's doing. Remember what happens in Job chapter 1? There's a conversation that goes on between Job and Satan, and it has nothing to do with whether or not God is trustworthy. What's the conversation in Job 1 that happens between God and Satan? God says to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job?" And Satan says, "As a matter of fact, yes, I have." And you know what? I think the only reason Job, if I can paraphrase Satan in Job 1, the only reason Job serves you, God, is basically because you have blessed him so much. Take away his stuff, and it'll curse you. The question the book is meant to answer is basically, will a man do what's right not because God blesses him and gives him everything he can want out of life, but will a man do what's right simply because it's right, even if there is no benefit in this life? That's the question that God and Satan have raised, and that's what the story is all about. The book is not a question about answering a question about God. The book is asking a question about us. Do not put God to the test. And that, in a very real sense, when you read the book of Job completely through, that's what Job and his friends and ultimately God and Satan, that's what the great wrestling match is all about. Is, will Job do what's right, not because he wants his blessing back, but will Job do what's right simply because it's right, even if there is no immediate payoff in this life? And when you work your way all the way through the book, it turns out that, as a matter of fact, God was right about Job. Job will do what's right. Job will confess the truth simply because it's true. Not because God makes him rich or gives him lots of kids or a good family life. Ladies and gentlemen, when it comes to the Bible at the 30,000-foot level, the biggest possible perspective, the Bible reminds us that the real questions that matter are not questions about God. The real questions that matter are questions about us. And so when Satan pulls Psalm 91 out on Jesus and says, "Hey, listen, let's take God for a test drive here," Jesus comes back and says, "No, the real question is not whether or not God is trustworthy. The real question is whether or not man is trustworthy. Do not put God to the test. Will man simply obey rather than test God? Will he trust instead of testing?" And so again, the challenge of Psalm 91 is not that the psalm as a whole does not apply to Jesus or to any other faithful person for that matter. The real issue is that whether it's Psalm 91 or any other text in the Bible that issues great and precious promises of God, and especially texts that we like but we so often find confusing, texts that talk about how God is going to provide for and protect his people. The question becomes then, whether or not these texts give us the right to demand of God the where, the when, or the how of his faithfulness to us. And so what do we do? What do we do with passages in the Bible like Psalm 91? Is there any spiritual value to be regained from them, or do we just basically stay away from them because Satan abuses them and tries to get us to abuse them as well? What do you do with a psalm like Psalm 91? Three observations very quickly, and we'll bring this to an end this evening. Like Psalm 91 to us. Number one, what Psalm 91 reminds us, when we read these great passages in the Bible full of God's great promises about how he will provide and protect his people, number one, we've got to understand that we have to live without the type of proof we sometimes crave. We simply have to learn to trust God, not test him. And that means we're going to have to live without the type of proof that we often crave. Now, I think there's plenty of proof to believe in God. I think there's plenty of proof and the historical record, to believe in God, to believe in the miracles that have been worked and the events that have happened and God's control over things. I think there's plenty of proof. But the problem is, you and I, ladies and gentlemen, we are often not satisfied with the proof that exists. We often want more. We want some sort of vision in the night. We want some sort of voice from heaven. We want some sort of angelic visitor. That's the temptation so often. We want God to speak directly into our life, our situation. We want God to immediately and experientially hold our hand. We want the kind of proof that God's going to deliver us. That's some sort of concrete, personal, individual way. And the reality is, the Bible, nowhere in the Bible does God ever offer that to us. We are going to have to learn to live without the sort of immediate, personal, experiential proof of God's presence and provision that we sometimes crave. Again, using Psalm 91, the whole thing is Satan often doesn't appreciate. He pulls the one part out about basically angels attending and no feet being dashed on the stones. But ultimately, God from heaven says this at the end of the psalm. Listen again, Psalm 91, beginning verse 14. Listen to what God from heaven says about all this. Because he has loved me, therefore I'll deliver him. I will set him securely on high because he has known my name. He will call upon me and I will answer him. I will be with him in trouble. I will rescue him and honor him. With a long life I'll satisfy him. Let him see my salvation. Because he loved me and because he calls upon my name. That's the language of trust and dependence, not demand. What God is looking for is love and dependence, not demand. God never gives away anywhere in the Bible, anywhere in prophecy, to any apostle. God never gives away all that he knows. God's never told any human being all the whys and the hows and the whats of his ways on the earth. No, God says, what I'm looking for is people who love me, who simply value me for myself rather than just trying to use me, test me, prove me, see what I'm made of. People who love me for myself, for who and what I am, for what I've already done, offered, and promised. And people who depend upon me, who call upon my name without having to test me or prove me first. That's what I'm looking for, says God. That's what I desire. So we're going to have to learn to live without the type of proof we sometimes crave. God doesn't promise it, God doesn't offer it, and we are in the wrong when we expect it or ask it. But the second thing we need to understand from this psalm is that, number two, we need to know the difference between testing and trusting. We need to know the difference between testing God and trusting God. See, here's the thing. We are culturally conditioned in our time and our place. We are culturally conditioned to crave control over our lives. We are culturally conditioned to crave control. So for a lot of people, religion becomes kind of a do-it-yourself approach to life. Religion becomes a do-it-yourself approach to life where we use religion and we use God and we use doing right and avoiding wrong. We use it to get what we want out of life. God, religion, the Bible becomes just merely tools to be used for my benefit, to get me out of trouble when I'm in trouble, to get me well when I'm sick, to get me a job when I have none, to provide stuff for me when I don't think I have enough. And so too often we come to God in that superstitious way where we're testing God, we're proving God, and we're trying to control and manipulate what God's going to do and when and how he's going to do it. What we're really doing is we're no different than the world and the rest of culture, which is basically trying to manipulate God or the gods or whatever any pagan believes in. Here's what trusting in God looks like instead of testing him. Trusting in God means, as a contrast, that I'm going to allow God to do his work, with his creation, with his creatures, in his own time, and in his own way. Now, do you hear me how many times I said his? God's going to do his work in his creation, with his creatures, in his own time, and in his own way. Because you know what? It's all his. That includes me. And so I'm going to learn to trust in God. I'm going to let God be God. I'm going to learn to let God be God. Listen, I love having conversations with my kids. One of the precious parts of being a parent, many of you can identify with that. I love having conversations with my kids. I love provoking them and asking them questions and getting something going. I love it when they come and they want to talk to me and ask me about something. And I love it when my children ask why, because I want them to learn how the world works and why things are the way they are to the best of my ability to teach them and shape them and show them. But here's the thing, ladies and gentlemen, here's the thing. And if you have children, you know this, that a lot of times in conversations with our kids, there gets to a point where they're asking why once too many times. And so how often do we sometimes get to a point with our children where, as much as we want to explain some of it to them, at the end of the day, we have to tell our children to quit asking questions. Don't worry about it. Just do what you're told. You ever had to have that conversation with your kids? No more whys. Don't worry about why. Just do what I said. Some of you are smiling because you're in that position. You know all too well. We understand in life that as much as we like to talk to our kids, it's like as much as we like to explain to our kids as much as we can. Listen, at the end of the day, if Joel still can't get his mind around why I don't want him running out in the street, then because I said so is going to have to be it. And we're not going to talk about it anymore. Just do what you're told. Now here's the thing. The gap between ourselves and our children when it comes to this kind of stuff, the gap between ourselves and our children is so much less. I mean, think about it. Our children are eventually going to become adults like us, at least hopefully. Eventually, our children are going to replace us. They're going to become the adults that take our place when we get old and we die. In case you didn't know, having children is a confession of your own mortality. You're raising your replacement. There's a much less of a gap between myself and my children than there is between myself and my God. Because I will never, no matter how much I grow, mature, pursue righteousness and holiness, I will never replace my God. I will never take his role the way my son will eventually take my role. How much more then, if we all with our children get to a point where we have to simply say, listen, no more why, don't worry about it, just do what you're told. How much more with the God of heaven, with mere creatures, mere dust then? Do we sometimes get to a point in our relationship with God where there's no more why, there's no more testing, there's no more questioning, there's just trust. Do it because he says so. So one of the things that Psalm 91 reminds or forces us to confront is the fact that we're going to have to understand the difference between testing and trust, between Satan's abuse of this psalm and Jesus' response to this psalm. But number three, I want you to understand something this evening, and that's that everyone has aspects of their life where they are challenged to choose trust. Everyone, every human being has aspects of their life where they are challenged to choose trust. And by the way, that includes Jesus. Otherwise, it wouldn't have been much of a temptation by Satan, would it have been? If it was really impossible, at least cause a wavering of doubt or a little of confusion or concern. Listen, Jesus, Satan says, if you're really the Son of God, let's find out if his promises are dependable or not. Let's see what happens when you jump. Let's see if Psalm 91 is true or not. Because again, that's how we often do it, isn't it? If God said nothing bad will ever happen to me, well, at least in my simplistic reading of his promises, then that means nothing bad is ever going to happen to me on my own terms. Let's find out. Even Jesus had aspects of his life where there was a struggle. There was at least a temptation, a trial to choose trust. But of course, Jesus, in this temptation, he shows us how to rightly read these sorts of texts in the Bible where God does apparently seem to say, no evil is going to befall you. 1,000 may fall, even 10,000 at your right hand, yet it's not going to get to you. And yet, all of us who live life much at all understand that sometimes it does get to us. So what in the world's going on here? Satan's raised a legitimate point in the sense that how do we rightly read these texts? If it's not what Satan's trying to do, which is what a lot of people try to do with the Bible, which is make a simplistic, nothing bad will ever happen to you, just watch. If God's serious, what do we do with it? Well, Jesus here shows us how to rightly read these sorts of texts in the Bible. Jesus shows us that God's promises are not magical talismans that protect every individual from every misfortune. No, Jesus shows us that we are called to trust in God in a way that is not a simple, warm, fuzzy attitude, but a trust that is deep, a trust that is substantial, a trust, a lifestyle that waits without worry, because we've already seen that God always keeps his promises, but what we have also seen is that also God likes to keep his promises in ways that nobody saw coming. That's just as much how God works as the fact that he delivers. That we've lived long enough, and we've read long enough, and we have a deep enough faith that we've already seen that God always keeps his promises, even if from our perspective, he lingers in doing so sometimes. See, Jesus, like we need to be able to, Jesus could look to the past. He could look to God's dealings with Israel, just like we can still to this day, to know that when God was ready to do so, he was more than capable of doing what he promised. Listen, he made promises to Abraham, you're going to get that land, but you know what? God waited 4 centuries to make it happen. But when he was ready, you know what? The promise happened. That's how God works. You can't force him. You can't make him do it on your time schedule. But when God is ready to do it, God keeps his promise. Ladies and gentlemen, it's called faith because we choose what God says over what we experience or expect in our own individual lives. That's why it's called faith. That's why it's called trust. See, my framework for judging God's faithfulness and dependability is not limited to my own lifetime or my own immediate circumstances. Jesus rightly understands that you cannot put God to the test by basically saying, I'm going to jump, and if he doesn't catch me right now, then he somehow has failed. No, gravity just won because you were a fool for jumping. Jesus understood that. That our framework for judging God's faithfulness is not limited to our own lifetime in terms of a time span, nor is it limited to my own individual immediate circumstances. I live in Daniel chapter 3. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they understood this. They got this. They understood this. Daniel chapter 3, remember, it's a story when Nebuchadnezzar, he builds that great golden statue. Remember this, how the story goes? Basically, he gathers all the high-up officials of Babylon, which included Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He gathers them all up, and he basically says, when you hear the music, you bow down, or else. And so the first time the music plays, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are the only ones who don't bow down. And as is so often in life, they're ratted out. That's how Nebuchadnezzar finds out. He didn't see them. He was told. He calls them up. In Daniel chapter 3, beginning in verse 14, Nebuchadnezzar says to them, is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I've set up? Now, if you're ready, when you hear basically the sound of the music to fall down to worship, well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning, fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands? To which Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered, oh, Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. In other words, we don't have to think about it. We already know what our answer is. And it's this. If this be so, in other words, you throw us in the fiery furnace. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not what? You ever think about that for a second? What does he mean, if not? If God doesn't spare their lives when they're thrown into the fiery furnace. That's what they mean. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. No, Nebuchadnezzar, despite your blasphemy, we are fully convinced that God promises deliverance and protection to his people. We know that he is capable of delivering us. But we also know that because of the way God works in the world, he, even if you do throw us in, while he's perfectly capable of delivering us, there is no guarantee that he will choose at this time in this way to deliver us. Because you know what? Everybody dies eventually anyways. Maybe this is God's will for how we're going to die today. Who knows? The point is, we don't know what God's up to, they say. We know he's capable. We know that he makes promises. We know he's a great deliverer. But if he doesn't and chooses not to, and we die at your hand in a horrible flaming death, you know what? He's still God. You understand that? He's still God. Everyone has aspects of life where they are challenged to choose trust over testing. And so Jesus understands when it comes to Psalm 91, it's not that it's not true. It's not that it doesn't apply. It's this. That ultimately Jesus understood that this psalm has to be basically fulfilled by God at the right time in God's way rather than forcing God's hand. And one of the things I like about it is the gospel writers don't have to throw in the details that they do, but they do for a reason. Did you notice at the end of the temptation then, the angels do show up? But it's God's decision and God's timing rather than Jesus forcing it. Satan in the process of temptation reminded Jesus, you know, Psalm 91 says basically, you know, God's going to deliver you. The angels are going to have charge concerning you. And you know what? Jesus, rather than testing God, trusts God. You know what happens in the end? In God's good time, the angels show up and minister to him, the text says. See, Jesus understood that this psalm is true, it's real, it's dependable, but you don't force God to fulfill it when he wants to, the way he wants to. And so Matthew 4, verse 11, the devil left him and the angels came and they were ministering to him. The angels did have charge of him and they did help him, they did comfort him, God did provide for him, but the angels came on God's own timing. And so because of that, when you read the whole context of Psalm 91, the passage that Satan tried to get Jesus to test God with rather than to trust God with, he will give his angels charge concerning you to guard you in all your ways, and they will bear you up in their hands. Yeah, that happened just in God's way, not Jesus' forced way. But notice how the rest of the psalm goes on. Did you catch that? And you will tread upon the lion and the cobra, the young lion and the serpent you will trample down. The young lion and the serpent you will trample down. Did you catch the echo there? Did you catch the echo? Oh, Satan was ironically talking about a passage that in some ways related to his own demise. The ability of the people of God when God is ready to trample all their enemies underfoot, just as Jesus would in fact do with the serpent of old, the devil himself, to trample him down. Jesus will be the one who tramples the servant. He will be the one who, through per the rest of the psalm, depends upon God, and therefore God gives him, provides for him life. With long life, I will satisfy him. Let me ask you something this evening. Did God give Jesus long life? The correct answer is yes. He died on the cross, but what happened on the third day? Well, not just long life, better than long life. What happened? Eternal life. On God's own timing. In God's own way. Because despite Satan's best efforts to force us to test God, when we trust God, God does keep his word. But in all the ways that Satan and humans certainly wouldn't have expected, God kept this psalm, even in Jesus' own life. And yet God's way of securing Jesus is much, much better than the security Jesus would have found if he had attempted to force God's hand and jumped off that temple that day. You understand that? The way God provided for Satan to crush serpents. The way God provided for Jesus to be ministered to by angels. The way God provided for Jesus to see not just long life, but even eternal life. Raised incorruptible. The first fruits of the dead, the apostle says. Oh, far better what Satan was trying to get God to force, or get Jesus to force God to do for him. Far, far better. Because Jesus had to trust, not to test. And so we'll close this way this evening. It's interesting, Psalm 91, rightly understood, Jesus, of course, comes back to. Here's what's interesting. Satan, of course, quotes it in the temptation. Later on in Jesus' ministry, Jesus quotes it. It's in Luke chapter 10. Jesus comes back to the psalm on his own time, in his own way, rightly using it. Luke chapter 10, here's what's going on as we bring this to a close this evening. In Luke chapter 10, Jesus is in the heart of his ministry. He's on his way to Jerusalem to die by this point in the story. The end of his ministry draws near. And as the time of his ministry, the time of his work on earth is winding down, in Luke chapter 10, he sends 70 of his disciples out to basically spread the good news of his work and his coming kingdom. He sends them out. And then they come back to him. They bring good news about how the word has been spread. And in Luke chapter 10, and beginning of verse 17, the 70 returned with joy to Jesus. And they said, "Lord, even the demons are subject to us in your name." And he gets down to verse 19, and his response to them over their excitement and their joy over the work of God that's being done through them and for them. Jesus says this to them as part of his response. Verse 19, "Behold, I've given you authority." And here he subtly references Psalm 91, verse 13. "Behold, I've given you authority to tread on serpents and scorpions and over the power of the enemy. Nothing will injure you. Nothing will befall you." Psalm 91 language. "Nevertheless, do not rejoice in this, that the spirits are subject to you, but rejoice that your names are recorded in heaven." Here's what's really interesting, though, and here's what we learn about the right way to understand God's promises. You understand what he's doing as he subtly and carefully sneaks in that Psalm 91 reference and what he's done with them and for them. What he shows us is this: the promises of God's protection are not individually oriented in a selfish sense. You're protected, he basically says to them. You can trample down the serpents and the scorpions and no evil will befall you, so to speak. You can do this because you're serving God by accomplishing His specific purposes. You are saved and you are protected to serve God and to complete His purposes. See, too often, ladies and gentlemen, we want to claim the God promise of God's protection rather selfishly for our own immediate personal needs. The point Jesus is getting at his disciples is the right way to read the psalm and God's promises of protection is ultimately that God protects us so that we can fulfill His purposes in this world and in this life. After all, isn't that how Jesus, in a sense, found Himself living Psalm 91? He was untouchable by His enemies until the moment when God wanted Him touched. Invincible, as it were, to those who would kill Him sooner. Until God says, it's time and my purpose for your life to be given. And then even then, did God really abandon Jesus? Oh, not in the ultimate sense. Because on the third day, Jesus found not just long life, but eternal life. God keeps His promises just for different reasons and in different ways than we often expect, anticipate, or ask for. But when we, like Jesus, learn how to better read our Bibles, learn the difference between testing and trusting, then we're much better, much more assured of God's protection. Because ultimately we know that God will keep His purposes, God will keep His promises in ways far better than we can ask or think. If we'll simply do our part, not put them to the test, as Jesus reminds us, quoting Deuteronomy 6, but simply obey what He tells us to do. Would you obey God this evening? We'd like to help you with that if that's your desire. If you'd like to trust in God tonight, no more testing Him, no more sitting there and asking questions, and that could always go on forever about how God and why this and anything like that. You're just ready to trust in God tonight. We want to help you with that. If you're willing to come forward and confess that Jesus is Lord, Savior, Son of God, don't understand how He did all that He did, but you understand that God became flesh and dwelt among us. You make that confession tonight, repenting of your sins. We'll baptize you for the forgiveness of those sins tonight. You're not your child of God already, but you've been living a life that's testing God's patience, testing His purposes for your life rather than living a life of trusting obedience to Him. Pray to God for forgiveness. We can pray with you, for you, encourage you, hold you accountable in some way. Why don't you come talk to us right now while we stand and while we sing.